there, as the immense power of the open Pacific broke on the shore of this fragile community, all 500 souls in that village participated in a ritual of recovering our place in creation. It was a meeting with angels, the messengers of the sacred. Coiled on the gray sand of the beach was a rope that extended through the surf to a shoreline at the opposite end of the bay. The rope is a focal thing for fisher peoples of all races and clans. It is a tool of rescue, of securing fast to land or rock in storms. It is repaired with diligence. It is something that is made of human hands, weaving together many strands. The strands are stories and filaments of myth. The strands are life and death. The strands are ethos and mythos. All of us, old and young, and this Mamakni and my partner, another Mamakni, placed the rope between our hands. And at a signal from the elders, we began to pull the rope, bringing the seven back into our lives and bringing balance back to the cosmos. Sea, land, human society, other and same, and the gift of flesh held spirit were brought back into proper relationship. There on the sand, of a million waves. The relationship and the gifts of rope, hands, and those dark angels of hope, the wolves, rescued human being back into the dark mystery of creation. And my vision could never be clarified of such distressing joy or the presence of such dark angels. As St. John of the Cross once wrote, "O guiding night, O night more lovely than the dawn." This way, as long as you can touch each other's faces and see each other's eyes. Do you have clean hands? Oh. I know you probably don't. It's hard to explain the depth of that experience, which has pushed me off of all sorts of nice, comfortable, mechanical, theological answers to all problems. I went to the village, as I said, a Christian Marxist coming out of liberation theology. Not so bad. But I went there with the rather bizarre belief that as a Mamakni, as a Western Protestant cleric, that I could actually save the village and bring them to full humanity. That's our problem. James Everett the Trickster, Bradley, one day by hand, it was a bench that was in front of Edgar Charlie, who was a bit of a jerk, but anyway, at Edgar Charlie's house, Edgar was one of the chiefs, and his display of his lack of care for others was pretty well exhibited in the village, but James grabbed me by the hand and sat me down and said, "Shut up. and listen. And in terms of your reflecting on the land and reflecting on its meaning, and I would say its spirit, shut up and listen. It's damn good advice. But you have to be able to listen, was the trick I had to learn. Because the layer of the techniques that I learned them pretty well. I actually was a very good theological student, not great, unfortunately. Meant to go on to PhD level, but the problem is I had learned theology as a set of techniques to explain the mystery rather than a set of tools and disciplines that would open me to know the mystery, to know what, you know, what this very small mind could possibly know. And then, hopefully, to respect the unknowing and to be with the unknown. That's really hard for us. At least those of us who are Euro-Americans. But there's a man who knows all the answers.
I mean, this last comment of yours is really to what I was thinking about. I mean, you grew up with the myth. You grew up with a particular biblical Christian story that speaks about or speaks to the great questions of human life, invites people to be present to those questions. And within the Christian tradition, there is an amazing body of dramas, certainly as amazing as the rope one that you described. What happened? Like, why the hell didn't you have access to it? How does it come about that gets colonized?
Yeah.
I mean, you've described the other part of the danger colonization.
Yeah.
How did that get colonized?
I knew he was going to ask that question.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. We've been talking about it all day. I mean, back and forth on it.
I mean, it's so amazing.
This is a hard, hard confession for me to make because I was born into the mystery, into the story, received it in the cornrows from my father's lips, you know, received the mystery. But something happened in seminary. Seminary is a training in using technique and technological devices in the biggest term of that, you know, technological. In fact, the reason, this is, David, I mean, you've heard me say this, the reason I sought ordination rather than doing my PhD and teaching, which I love to do as well, was because of the mystery of the Eucharist. And yet, the mystery was pounded, not literally pounded out of me, by my classes in liturgical studies, my classes in worship, and even, you know, I love John Cobb, my mentor in terms of theology. I think he still had a sense of the mystery, but my attempt to intellectually move through the material that he was giving us, rich and profound as it was. However, the thing that I learned in the seminary was to apply a technique and not even to use the tools that were being offered to me. And I think here's the dangerous comment. I think that's unfortunately what the university is all about, is teaching technique. It's not teaching understanding or knowledge or wisdom or ultimately openness to mystery. It has a hard time with that. And yet I go, you know, I of course go back to Aristotle, Plato, I go back to the origins of the university, which I would argue was a place for seeing, experiencing, and perhaps knowing something of the mystery, but not of reducing it reducing it to something we can mold and something we can manipulate and something that becomes ultimately simply another technique. Too long an answer.
I asked this question as a current diaconal candidate of the United Church.
Oh, what's that church?
So no offense, or no pressure, but you have to provide me some vocational hope in your response. I really like how you described how seminary and ordination sort of reduced and colonized the mystery for you. And so you stand here as the rest of the story. How do you unpractice, given this formative experience that you had with the village, how do you have another example of how you unpractice that in your current ministry or in your current work?
I'm trying real hard. But it's so pervasive. This won't help you.
Thanks for that.
This is a very bizarre response, and it's a bizarre response from a father who just received a phone call from my daughter this afternoon on my cell phone. It's not a smartphone; it's just a cell phone developed. And the way I commonly listen to voices on the cell phone is as abstractions. However, I have had to learn how to hear beyond the techniques and the technology of real presence. The only way I can say this, it is a form of contemplative attentiveness to those who are there and to the sacred in the Sarx, the holy in the flesh. It is a form of attentiveness and discipline to attend to the other. The problem for us is... You can report me to the United Church of Canada. I'm not a happy camper in the United Church of Canada. The United Church of Canada was born, in one way, it was simply born out of the practicalities of having a damn big country and all these, three churches in a village of 200 or something. Finally, they said, what are we doing this for? But it was also born out of a utilitarian view of the gospel. It viewed the gospel as a technique and almost a technology to be applied to however we want to talk about salvation, to save, rather than as an entry point into the experience of the wonder and the mystery of the divine incarnate in flesh and blood. We're wedded to that. David, you've got... The copy of the red book. He has a wonderful thing. He talks about the two twins, right? Say more about that. It might help. I know nothing I said helps, but
well, if you think of the biblical narratives that in the last 100 years or so, there have been two primary ways of reading those narratives. One is a kind of evangelical literalist way of reading them, and another is a liberal modernist way of reading them. So my argument is simply that both of these ways of reading were born from the 18th century, from the development of the Age of Reason. So the narratives were read through a prism of trying to understand what's historically real in these narratives. I mean, was Jesus really born of a virgin? Like, what does that possibly mean? Or was Jonah really swallowed by a big fish? So on the one side, you get one argument about it, on the other side, you get a different argument. But the issue, if we can just come back to you here, I think, is that this is a tragedy that it was read this way. Because if you read the Bible that way, and it makes no difference which side you're on, if you do that for 100 years, your grandkids are going to realize the text ain't worth listening to. Because you have robbed it and stripped it of its capacity to speak to the great, into the great questions of human life. Those stories aren't about history. They are, to use Daniel's term, about mythos. That is, they are about ultimate meaning. And they give you a landscape in which to consider. They help deepen your capacity to be present to your own experience about those matters and to open to them as opposed to have an answer. And of course, we've had preaching based on that. It's no wonder nobody goes to church. The clergy have convinced people it's meaningless.
Art's sister still turns up.
Pardon. I didn't really mean that.